Mark, thank you for joining us on the Law Business Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have lots of questions for you because you've had a fascinating career that covers the subjects of law and technology and diplomacy, interestingly enough. And you're actually based in Switzerland. That's correct, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, I live in the Alps. I'm moving house next month, but only across the village. And so we're looking out at mountains, high trees, cloud, and there's still a little bit of snow on the upper reaches of the mountains around. So yes, it's very much driving, hairpin bends, and yes, I'm just a few miles south of Montreux in a canton in Switzerland known as the Valais, which some people will know. It's further down you get to Zermatt and Sasbey and famous places like that.
I mean, that sounds idyllic and a lifestyle that many people, I think, would aspire to. Is it something that you envisaged when you started off in technology?
No. I started out as a telecom engineer in Britain, building what became parts of the digital telephone network. I was working for a company, well, it was called Plessy's when I first joined, part of the Plessy organization, and but we were building equipment really to go to British Telecom. I think it was actually still the post office when I first joined, but that would be 1983. So yes, I spent a fair bit of time in telecom, and then I got headhunted to Microsoft to do some telecom stuff for them.
Wow. So it sounds as if you've always been involved in developing things that are used by many, many people. And perhaps in
That's
companies,
true.
Yeah, that have a huge share of a market. Obviously, Microsoft has a huge share of the personal computing market. And I'm guessing what you're doing in the cloud, developing the cloud, will affect many people's working lives. So could you just very basically explain?
What I do, my job title is a technical diplomat, and it's my job to negotiate international standards in particular, but also some other types of international agreements or multi-company collaborative work together where we're trying to find a common way forward for a technology. So it's diplomacy in the sense that I'm in a room with a lot of other people, some of whom have very different business objectives to my own company. But you know, we're there because we do have some things in common that we're trying to achieve.
That's really fascinating. And do you find that the people who you engage more diplomatically with have this sort of technical underpinning to their skill set and knowledge as well? Or are they mainly people who are engaged with partnership making and those sort of business development things?
We get both. We get a very broad group of people. Some people are concerned mostly with things like policy, government affairs, government relations, and therefore, you know, what new regulation might come down the line. So what can we do to make that easier to deal with or to head it off and find a better way? Some people will be deep engineers who know intimately how their product works and what they can change to make it do something differently or why they can't. Some people are, you know, more just concerned with the legal aspects. We have intellectual property people who are concerned. You know, some companies will try to inject their own patents into the idea so that they can erect a toll booth on it later. Others will be doing exactly the opposite and advocating for a very open source, open model. But everybody's really pursuing their own business objectives. But usually there's some sort of common goal that we're aiming for. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the room.
Absolutely. And I understand that you work with legal teams within Microsoft. And what do you think makes a successful lawyer within a commercial business like Microsoft? What personal attributes do you think?
We're a little unusual, but there are a number of very fundamental differences, I think. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm an engineer with a master's in law from the University of Law. But so I'm an engineer with some legal training, which is enough to make me dangerous. I can't give legal advice to anybody. You know, I don't have any attorney-client privilege or anything like that. But I do have a fairly good grasp of general aspects of law across, and it was an international, you know, I did the international legal practice, LLM, and that gives a very good background in the way the different legal systems approach things. And I think I'm going off your question, but
that's fine.
Within a commercial, within a business, a lawyer has, you know, there are different types of things. I mean, a lot of our lawyers are involved in sort of nitty gritty contract work, which is true in legal practices anywhere. But then there are some people like there's a lady lawyer on my team who she sits on the board of the ANSI, which is the American National Standards Institute. And she's an expert in matters of the governance of standards organizations, how they develop due process and how they follow it to make sure that everybody is operating within the law and that, you know, due process is followed. Everybody gets their fair say, and that there's no undue influence or bias built into the system. So, you know, she's works at a very high level, and my vice president that I work for used to be a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission in the United States. So she's given evidence to the Senate. So you've got people who operate at that very high political level as lawyers, but then there's still a lot of people doing nitty gritty, you know, sign this contract with this company, just agree the text sort of work. There are some differences. One is I don't think most lawyers in a corporation have to do timesheets, you know, or chase down billable hours, because yes, you're being paid to provide a service to your clients. But the clients are in-house, so you're getting a salary for that, and there might be a bonus plan or whatever. I have one, but it's not tied to particular, you know, it's just a general thing. So I think that's probably a relief for some lawyers that, you know, the idea of chasing billable hours is perhaps not quite what they really wanted to join the profession in. And I think also there's opportunities for some jumping around between topics and trying different things. Certainly with a company like Microsoft, we have the advantage that we have so many different products that touch on different areas of life. So you'll have some things like a search engine where you've got to consider all the advertising law. And other things you've got, you know, we make the Xbox game console. So you've got children playing that. So you've got all the child safety things. You've got all of the, the copyright protection and patents in special inventions and a great deal of that sort of material as well. And so I think within the Microsoft legal department, there are so many areas. And I mentioned government affairs. There's competition affairs. Dealing with, you know, antitrust and competition law, but so many other things as well.
So obviously Microsoft attracts a lot of talent early on in their careers. I know it's not perhaps your area, but could you give any of our listeners perhaps some tips that would make them really employable to a company that innovates like Microsoft?
Well, Microsoft is a multinational. So in that sense, we have subsidiaries in many different countries around the world. So there are certainly advantages in knowing about other legal systems as well as your home one.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, for Microsoft, it's as what most of the legal department think in terms of American law. So you sometimes need to be able to provide advice that, no, actually, it's not done like that in Europe. You know, and I've had to remind some people, for example, corporate counsel in America have attorney-client privilege with their own company, but you don't have that in Europe. It's only outside counsel who have that. So we have to remind people, you know, you can't mark this one as attorney-client privilege because you're not an outside counsel. You're an internal lawyer, so you don't get that. So there are sort of things like that. And then when they're dealing with the civil law on the continent, then, of course, that's a rather different way of going about things as well. So.
And for those who aren't perhaps.
I think a breadth of knowledge is going to be helpful.
Yeah.
Enthusiasm is certainly obviously important. I wouldn't worry too much about knowing the details of the technology, though obviously it doesn't hurt. But knowing how the law and, you know, recent cases that have affected the company or that part of the industry or regulations is going to count for quite a lot. I mean, for example, we've got the new free flow of non-personal data regulation in the EU, which is sort of you could say it's like the GDPR for all the other data that's not personal.
Okay.
But there's rights to move it around between, you know, to get your data back from a cloud service provider and put it to somebody else and things like that. So that's the sort of thing that you get a lot of discussion around at the moment.
That's fascinating. And I'm just thinking about your time at ULaw. And obviously you were working in technology at the time mm-hmm. when you did your LLM. Did you consider other routes in
yes.
terms of law? And what did you consider?
In terms of law, well, I was coming in as I was 49 years old, so this, I was not typical. And I had to make a case that they could put me onto an LLM when I hadn't done any undergraduate. But I had done a fair bit of work in the legal department. I'd got, you know, like 10 or 12 patents to my name, though they're all expired now. So I'd had various contact with legal aspects, and I was working in television and television content protection, which has a lot of legal aspects to it. So I knew I wanted to get back on a steep learning curve. I think in any job you have the risk of getting into a bit of a rut, and even if you are still learning new things, you're not on that sort of same steep path as sure. you are when you're at university or in the early years of your job. And as you get, you know, a few more grey hairs, then there's always the worry that, you know, your employer will start to think that you've peaked. So it doesn't hurt to remind them that actually you really do want to learn more and to challenge yourself. And that's certainly something Microsoft as a company encourages. And I know many of the other big companies as well, that they're looking for continued personal development, not just in the lawyer sense of CPD, but in the engineering sense and in broadening your knowledge as well. I mean, I guess for most engineers at that stage of their career, they're looking, if they want to do something like that, a lot of them will look towards an MBA rather than law, or some of them might go for an accountancy degree or something like that. But I've, you know, led teams before, and I wasn't madly thrilled at it. I certainly didn't want to mess with budgets. So I wanted to do something where I felt that what I learned would be directly applicable, but also move me out of that one zone into a broader area. And really, there are very few people who are qualified as both an engineer, because I'm a chartered engineer with the IET, but qualified as an engineer and have a real legal qualification as well. And frankly, it's worth something. It really is to have, you know, a lawyer who can understand the engineering aspects or vice versa, and to be able to communicate and bridge across that gap between those two communities who often find it rather hard to understand one another's language.
That's really interesting. So as an individual, you've sort of found your niche gap in the market, so to speak. And, you know, you're obviously very valuable to the company. I'm wondering if there's anything that particularly inspired you when you did your LLM. So. Any module that was particularly
I started out on the intellectual property module because I already knew a fair bit about that, by nowhere near everything that was covered in that module. But it sort of gave me a soft landing into, you know, another phase of education. Now, this was back in 2010, I think, and it was all distance learning, and it was all remote recorded videos to watch. And you know, we still had a few books, but most of it was online. And then assessments and submissions to make to a tutor. But it meant that it fit completely into my rather random schedule, because in normal times I would quite often be flying off somewhere for a week to attend a standards meeting, and then, you know, flying back to Microsoft headquarters in the west coast of America, do that sort of three times a year, and occasional, you know, jobs in other places. So quite a lot of travel normally, and when not traveling, then virtual conferences like we're doing now, that's been pretty normal for me for since I first moved to Switzerland. In fact, even before that, and I moved here in 2003, and so, you know, that sort of distance learning, working from home nearly all the time, is my way. And the LLM remotely worked very well with that, because I didn't have to. I think there's only once or twice I had to ask to postpone an assessment. And that, you know, with a bit of notice, that was always acceptable. But it because there was this steady rhythm of work that had to be done, and you knew that you'd have like 2 weeks to do the next assessment or whatever, you know, you had to fit it into the schedule somewhere. But it wasn't rigid. And I could do the videos when I needed to, and the other exercises, and then work on the assessment with the tutor. So it fit pretty well, because I can't claim my days are full. I can't claim they're all long. I mean, some of my, like Monday morning for me is like a wasteland. There's not very much happening. But I can go out, and because of the way my work operates, I can go out and go to the shops or something like that during what would be somebody else's working day. You know, I'm not 9 to 5 at all. But then on other occasions, I'll have meetings going through the evening up until sometimes like 1 a.m. and then have to get up and chair a meeting at 7 a.m. the next morning. So I was a little shocked to see it. I got a report from our internal system that said, well, we noticed you did 8 hours of work outside your core hours this week. And I thought, oh, crikey, yes. So I showed that to my boss. He says, "Well, that's just how it is." But Microsoft's approach is that you're employed to do the job. You're not employed to sit at a desk from 9 till 5.
Yes, that's very.
And if you deliver all of your work in 2 hours on, you know, the beginning of Monday morning, that's fine, because you're being paid to do the work, not to to spend time sitting there.
Yeah, people have mentioned this culture of presenteeism that can sometimes occur, whereby, you know, you're bound to a desk in a certain space from 9 to 5, and it's being broken down more within the legal profession as people work remotely as well. So that's very interesting. Do you think it's a healthy way of working?
Yes, I think it depends very much on the person. I wouldn't call myself an introvert, but I'm not, you know, I'm not thrilled at sitting in an office with a lot of people all around me. Especially since, you know, for example, you know, I work for the global corporation. So my boss is in Dubai, and his boss is in Oregon, and his boss is in Redmond in Washington State. So when I'm actually, if I do go to the office in Geneva, you know, there's nobody else around that really knows what I do. Never mind, you know, working with them. Occasionally, you know, something might come up, but so it's not like I've got a social group in a physical space anytime. But when we do get back to regular meetings, you know, there are people from other companies that I know extremely well. You know, some of them have been to dinner at, you know, one of my previous houses. We had used to have dinner parties of the committee gathered, you know, people from other companies as well as Microsoft people. And that could be really nice. So there is social contact in that job, but it's it tends to be sort of with your opposite numbers rather than with people in your own company.
That's really
interesting in itself.
Yeah.
But we and sometimes one of the things I've learned is that, you know, you might have quite a heated discussion with somebody. You know, I have seen shoes banged on tables and people storming out swearing in French. Wow. It does happen once in a while. But usually I found, you know, if you can have that, you know, forthright exchange of views in the meeting and then go and have a drink together afterwards, then you're doing it right.
That is success, isn't it?
Because it's not about the person. It's not about the individuals. If you're, you keep the argument as professional on the topic, and you never make it personal. And I've always tried very hard to stay on good terms, even with the people that I'm fundamentally opposed to.
That's interesting. I just interviewed the head of our business school, and he very much encourages negotiation and persuasion as tools that students have when they leave the business school, but also sort of recalibrating the opinions of many people to assimilate and then come up with the best response that includes everybody to achieve the common goal. So, yes,
that's important. And one of the things that we value is diversity in that sense. So within our team, because of our geographical split, we've got people from a lot of different nationalities. But within the company, we have people who are differently able as well. Microsoft has a program of actively recruiting people with on the autism spectrum, for example.
That's great.
We have people who are blind and deaf, and our chief accessibility officer is a very smart lady, but she's profoundly deaf. So she usually has a signer, or she can lip read a lot. But she's very much welcome at the top level of the company. And if we try to get a good gender balance as well, though that's not always too easy. But in the legal department, I think we're very strong on that. And having those people with different experiences from different backgrounds, different needs, helps everybody to keep a broader focus. I've been fortunate. One of the projects I've worked on in Etsy is the European standard for accessibility in ICT. So that's something I care quite deeply about. And fortunately, I'm very much supported by my employer in that.
And it's great that you must have seen company culture, diversity culture, and other cultures develop in Microsoft throughout the years as you've been there many years. Have you seen much development in the past sort of 10 years?
I have, though perhaps not as much as you might expect, because when I first arrived there, I was astonished at how welcoming in diversity it was. Because even back in 1995, we had same-sex couples, and if they adopted a child, they would have all the same benefits as a regular couple having their own baby. It was always that was always the company way. We've got senior people of every color skin that you can imagine. So I think we actually started in the company, and it was already in a very good place. And it was already not much liked by some of the more, less progressive parts of society, because we were quite progressive. So I've been very glad to be part of that.
That sounds fantastic.
But yes, we still work at it. There are, for example, in America, they have a program we try to get outside counsel from law firms who are led by minorities, whether that's female led or African American or whatever. So so Microsoft uses its buying power to try to promote diversity as well as just what it does internally. And that can be extremely effective.
I'm sure that will be very inspiring to many of the students, especially who are listening. And we're very lucky at ULaw to have students from a whole breadth of different backgrounds, low-income backgrounds, people with disability, learning disabilities, physical disabilities, and from all manner of different backgrounds. So I'm sure they'll feel very inspired by the prospect of applying to similar companies. And I'm just wondering if you have any career goals that you'd like to share with them, some things that you haven't done yet that you would like to do.
Well, I'll be 60 in a couple of months. So at this point, my goals are mostly to stay where I am. That's a difficult one. I mean, it becomes to, at my stage, it's sort of like, when are you going to retire? But for me, I think I'm probably not going to retire anytime soon. you know, I know that we talk about judges going on into their 80s and things, but that's not restricted to them. I think if we're in a role where experience counts and a certain amount of gravitas perhaps counts, then, you know, why stop if you're still enjoying what you're doing? We had one of my colleagues who was in the same role. He was the National Standards Officer for the United States for Microsoft. And he was over 70 when he joined the company.
Wow.
And he was with us I went on trips with him to China. Marvelous chap. I'm still in touch with his widow because, you know, sadly he passed on and left a great hole for us. But, you know, the idea that you're sort of done and dusted at 60 or even 65 is just not necessarily true.
Sure. And it fits in with that idea of retraining or perhaps, you know, furthering your professional development through doing something like an LLM. So there isn't an expiry date on education or your job role.
Absolutely not. No, there's no real, I mean, my wife has just been talking about, or maybe she'll do a PhD. I mean, she's not as old as I am, but, you know, she's saying, well, once I've got, you know, the daughter out of the way and a bit of free time, that's a time to start, you know, do some real research PhD stuff, not just, you know, there is no end to education. And certainly I found that, you know, University of Law was very good for me in that respect. You know, I would say, you know, obviously some people maybe just won't quite make it. My wife wanted to be a barrister, but in the end, it didn't work out for her. But that doesn't mean that that's lost. It still can be something that's used, you know, because you haven't, what you've learned hasn't been lost.
Sure.
And there are probably still other opportunities where that experience and that knowledge is still going to be very valuable. So I would say, you know, even if things get rough with, you know, you don't pass the exams that you want, don't give up hope because there are other doors opening.
That's a really positive note. And I'm wondering if you think law teaches you to think in a certain way.
Yes, I think that's true. I certainly you use language in a slightly different way. Engineers do the same thing, by the way, but not in quite the same way. When we talk about precision in engineering, it's not quite the same as precision in English in law. But in both cases, you are always trying to look for, you know, the exception, the thing that hasn't been thought of, the thing that needs to be dealt with, whether you're trying to hunt down a bug in software code or whether you're trying to make sure that there isn't a loophole that somebody can slide out of what they're supposed to do in a contract. You know, those you both need that broad perspective and an ability to take in the big picture, but also to see what might or might not fit within it. We also, perhaps more with the engineers, you know, you're always on a learning curve because the world is changing around you. And I know that's certainly true in some aspects of law. Some of it hardly changes at all, but some things like family law, I know, change regularly. So maintaining that currency, maintaining that broad perspective and, you know, reading a lot, listening a lot and learning a lot as you go forward.
That's amazing and a really good note to sort of wrap up on. I do have another quite cheeky question about Microsoft, but to reflect a bit on that, it sounds as if you can be a lateral thinker as well as a really logical thinker in law and in technology, which is great because it will attract many different people. So, yeah, it's great to pass that on.
To be honest, it's the lateral thinking is where the big successes are in both law and in engineering. It's the guy who comes up with a wholly new way to do something or a new product, whether that's an iPad or something like that in engineering, or whether someone comes up with like a poison pill protection against takeovers in law. You know, it's that sort of rocket science inspiration of doing something different to the way it's been done before to achieve something for your business, for your client. yes, being able to be creative and think outside of the way it's been. I don't really like the term outside the box, but think of the problem as a whole rather than just the little bit that seems to be the problem at first sight.
Yes, and perhaps employing different modes of thinking, like law and technology modes of thinking, to achieve that sort of Einstein moment. Fantastic. My cheeky question about Microsoft is, I'm sure lots of people would love to know if you've met any of the founders, Bill Gates or Melinda.
I missed my chance to meet Bill Gates because when I joined, it was still a tradition that new employees would be invited to his home to say hello. But unfortunately, somebody scheduled a business trip on that time for me and I missed it. You only get one crack. I've shared an elevator and had a conversation with Steve Ballmer, who took over from Bill as chief executive. And I've met a few people that would perhaps be more famous in the technology community. But it's not really a celebrity company in the same way that some places like Apple are. But I remember being told, if you see somebody driving into the car park that's driving a Lamborghini, it's because he really wanted one. But it's not because he's trying to be a status symbol, because the building was absolutely full of millionaires. So right. You couldn't impress anybody that way.
Right.
And I know, I knew multimillionaires who would, drive to work in a pickup truck, and they would turn up to a meeting if you told them there was free food on offer. It's
your definition of success.
It's just people. They're really just people.
Yeah. People who have the freedom to make certain choices, which is great. And of course, what perhaps qualification in law and experience in technology will give you. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our ULaw community?
I don't know. I would say, yes, always look that little bit further afield. If you're looking at a subject, look a bit beyond it and see what are the things that affect that subject, whether that's history or related areas. Don't get blinkered and put a subject in a box that, in silos and think that this has nothing to do with that. Because, if you don't think there's a link between something like intellectual property and something like competition, you've missed it, because absolutely there are links there. So always look at a subject and read a little bit further around it and see how it fits into the bigger picture. Always look for the big picture.
Brilliant. And I think that thought will set up our students for success. So thank you very much, Mark. And we hope to hear much more from you in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tamsin.